It really is a pleasure, First Grace, to introduce Rudy Rasmus. You can read his long bio that's in our bulletin, and I want you to know it's not long enough. It should be about five. There should be a whole book written on Rudy instead of him writing another book. There is so much good that is happening in downtown Houston because he came to a church 22 years ago that they wanted to close and sell. And he said, you know, can I have that? Can I have that church? They said, Rudy, you've never been to seminary. He said, I've been to church. And here we are, 22 years later, and there's just a few more people than this there. So, you know, 9,000 or something like that that show up on Sunday morning and do a lot of good and make the disenfranchised feel like they're not disenfranchised. And that is what the church does. I simply want to say to you, First Grace, I wish everyone could have a two-hour dinner with Rudy Rasmus. This is what you would find out. He's just a man. He's just a human being like you. He's just trying to be a good husband of 28 years, trying to raise his two daughters who are in their 20s, trying to pastor that little church. There is no pretension in Rudy Rasmus. Every once in a while, the word God or Jesus comes up. But mostly it's just about this relationship between two people or three or four other people like there were last night. If I had to give one line to describe Rudy Rasmus, it would be that Rudy keeps it real. And that is why he is here today. Please come forward, Rudy, and let us welcome Rudy Rasmus.
Hey, it's so good to be here today. How's everybody doing? Good, good. Hey, man, I tell you, Sean, Ann, you know, these people know how to feed you. I ain't lying, all right? So I'm, and Broad, Celeste, thank you all for the hospitality. It has been a great 24 hours here in New Orleans. I love the city, and man, I really, every time I come here, I don't want to leave. I feel something every time I just leave the airport and start driving into the town, and I just thank each of you for letting me be myself. A couple things I want to do before I start preaching, because it is a difference between preaching and telling the truth. You'll get that a little later, all right? But first thing I want to do is just get a question out that I know. Often when I move around, I move around a lot. But there's a question that normally hits the minds of the person who encounters me for the first time. And I want you to do me a favor. Look at the person sitting next to you and just ask them, what in the heck is that under his chin? All right, will you do that? Just, what in the heck? So for those of you who hadn't read my story, heard my story, it's a filter, an F-I-L-T-E-R. And what it does, it helps me to detect judgmental people at a safe distance. Yeah. I'm rarely mistaken for a preacher, a pastor, rarely. Matter of fact, there are normally three classifications I fall into when people say, well, who, okay, now what do you do? What do you do? It's that question, especially on airplanes. If someone's sitting next to me, it's a matter of time before they get the courage, all right, to ask me, like, what is it you do? And what's number one? Number one, musician, right? Musician, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Especially whenever I head towards New Orleans, I'm always mistaken for a musician. Secondly, what am I mistaken for? An artist, all right? And thirdly, a drug dealer, all right? A drug dealer, that's right. That's my past. This is the only remnant. The only remnant. But it is... It's good. You guys probably know, but Jesus moved from Houston to New Orleans. Jesus moved from Houston to New Orleans a couple of years ago. As a matter of fact, Jesus sings in your choir. Philip Brent, every Easter, played Jesus in our play at St. John's. All right, it was just Philip. walked in the room and said, Jesus! Man. I got some kinfolk in the room. Jennifer, Joanne, Flora Jean, and Rob, and Thelma. I got some folk who've been coming, who came through the day to hang out. And that is my spiritual gift. I do have the spiritual gift of hanging out. That's what I do, all right? That's what I do. But I've been given 15 minutes. I now have 7.5 left, all right? But before I preach, I want to do this. Because I love the sound of church people lying to each other, will you do me a favor and just turn to a couple of people and say, I love you, and it's nothing you can do about it? Give it a try, all right? Give it a try. Yeah. I love the sound. It's like music to my ears. Bring you greetings from Juanita. That's my wife. She was on the road this week, also speaking. Actually, she would say she's on the road taking a break. We travel a lot, and when I'm away from her, I have a hard time sleeping. Once, not too long ago, I called. I said, "Baby, I'm having a hard time sleeping," and she said, "You are? I slept so good last night. All right, just I don't like that." Yeah, it made me mad. It made me real mad. But my title for today is Thanks for Crossing the Street. Look at your neighbor and say, thanks for crossing the street. Give it a try. Thanks for crossing. You know, this church has no challenge crossing the street. I've heard your story. I read your story. As a matter of fact, in national news, I was so excited when I saw the article maybe a year or so ago about First Grace. Just really being a part of your journey along the way. I've seen the development. I've seen the changes that have happened from afar. I haven't been in here, but I have been around. Hey, thank you. This is a good church, man. Church give you water, man. That's a good church. I ain't lying. All right. But you know, and it's evident that this church has crossed the street. I mean, you really have. You have boldly gone where few churches would dare to go. As a matter of fact, I would say you are right now manifesting a vision, a dream I've had since the very first day at St. John's in downtown Houston. The very first day. Very first day I walked in this building, 1992. I walked in, I looked around, and the vision the Lord put on my heart was people from every ethnicity worshiping together. 22 years later, you have been able to, we have not been able to do it. In 6 years, you have been able to do it. And I commend you. One of the hardest things to do is for folk from different experiences to come together and hang out on Sunday. And you have done it. You ought to show yourself some love. You have done something. Yeah, you have done something. And in this text, this afternoon, I want to just lift up one moment where Jesus was talking to a young scholar, and that young scholar in the midst of all of the dialogue that he had encountered with Jesus was asked Jesus, who's my neighbor? Verse 27. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Your neighbor is yourself. But wanting to justify himself, he looked at Jesus and said, who is my neighbor? And a little thought on that reveals that this young scholar was looking for a loophole. Looking for a way out. For those of you who thought loopholes were 20th century inventions to escape taxes, no, loopholes have been around a long time. They actually have derived from two words, lupin and hole. And a lupin hole was a spot, a place cut in the wall where a fighter would stick his musket through to shoot the other person. But this young scholar was looking for a loophole, and in the midst of looking for that narrow place, that open place, he was looking for a way around that identification as neighbor. And you know, when I think about the fact that Jesus was in this encounter, he was really talking to a group, really about another group. And he wanted to make sure that the folk in the room understood the importance of what loving God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and loving one's neighbor as oneself really was. See, one thing Jesus often did was he would put those around him to a test. He would first say something profound. And not long after saying something profound, he would follow it up with an exam. And in this text, we see the exam coming. We see the exam coming, and we find that this young scholar was really attempting to differentiate, make sure he had a clear understanding who Jesus was talking about, because there were a lot of rules back in that particular day. A lot of rules, about 613 to be exact. 365 of those rules were negative, and 248 of those rules were positive. And in the midst of it, Jesus broke all through all of those rules and said, love your neighbor as you love yourself. And you know what I think about the fact that this young scholar was looking for this loophole? I'm reminded of something I read in Eugene Peterson's book entitled Eat This Book, where he says the religious scholar's reason for asking Jesus to define neighbor was so he could consider someone else the neighbor other than who Jesus might have been referring to. Matter of fact, he wanted to psychically prepare himself to delineate. You know, when I think about psychic preparation, it happens all of the time, everywhere, and psychic preparation is really just putting yourself in the mindset of dehumanizing the other so that you won't have to qualify the other as one of your own. So really, when we think about this whole process of psychic preparation, I'm reminded of what happened during World War II. During World War II, Europeans were fighting Americans, and there were very few people of color in that battle. So what the folk had to do was prepare young white men in the West to fight young white men in Europe. And the only way they could do that was to put another face on them. So they would stand across the field from one another saying, aren't you my brother? But it's much easier to shoot a pig. So the propaganda, the marketing, all of the material that showed the enemy, the so-called enemy, showed the enemy with the pig's face on it. And that was psychically preparing another group of people who looked just like the other to annihilate them. Well, when I think about this young man who was attempting to escape that delineation, who was attempting to define for himself who the other was, I'm reminded that the love Jesus talked about wasn't preferential. You couldn't put that in a category. I'm reminded that neighbor means equality before God. And equality before God means that everyone becomes your neighbor. Imagine this: your enemy becomes your neighbor. Your adversary becomes your neighbor. The people you have learned to condemn become immediately your neighbor. Yes. The folk you never would have imagined become your neighbor. The people you have written off become your neighbor. The people you would least likely ever to consider a neighbor immediately become your neighbor. Do me a favor, look at the person sitting next to you and say, what's up, neighbor? In the midst of what looked like an intellectual wrestling match, Jesus begins to flip the script and tells a story about an unnamed brother who took a 17-mile journey down a dangerous and familiar road, the Jericho Road, and in the midst of that dialogue, he talked about a man who had been stripped and beaten, kicked to the curb, robbed. I'm reminded of of a story I read recently, and the story is about a little boy who was in class and in Sunday school, and his teacher asked, so tell us about that story. And the little boy said, oh yeah, I got it. It was about two preachers who saw a man in the ditch. But they kept walking because he had already been robbed. They were preachers from L.A. You'll get that on the way home, all right. So in the midst of this dialogue, Jesus begins to unpack the story about a religious professional. Some texts call him a priest. And a church worker. Some texts call him a Levite. Both going down the same road. Both see the same man. Both see him in distress. And both go to the other side of the road. And when I saw that, I was reminded of the words of Dr. Martin Luther King, who once said, any religion that professes to be concerned with the souls of men and is not concerned with the slums that damn them, the economic conditions that strangle them, and the social conditions that cripple them is a dry as dust religion. I prefer to call it crack religion. That hit will just get you high enough just to get you to the next hit, but won't sustain you in that moment when you don't have a piano, an organ, a choir. And then without warning, in this dialogue, Jesus flips the script once again. With scandal. Scandal. Shonda Rhimes couldn't compare to scandal like this. Olivia Pope couldn't compare to scandal like this. Jesus, out of nowhere, says the Samaritan stopped. Oh, man. The one who did the right thing from the wrong crowd. Hero from the hood. All of a sudden, turns the entire story into something of contempt. And I tell you, in the midst of this moment, we realize that there had been great tension for many years between Jews and Samaritans. Samaritans were Jews who after Israel had been defeated by the Babylonians, stayed behind and were intermarried with the Assyrians, who were considered the abomination by in sight of the Jews, and even built their own temple. So everybody knew that these weren't the real folk. And Jesus, in turn, makes the Samaritan the hero. Samaritan crossed the street, saw a man in danger, in peril, and went across the street. Saw a person challenged with a life challenging situation, and went across the street, and didn't just go across the street, but cared. And didn't just care, but provided for. When I think about what the Samaritan did, what the Samaritan really did was showed love. And there are many, many, many definitions of love, and we could spend another afternoon talking about the many definitions of love. But I like the definition that M. Scott Peck used. He said, love is extending oneself for the purpose of improving another's spiritual growth. Love. When I think about love, I'm reminded that love is as love does. You can talk about love all day long, but unless you demonstrate love, it's just talk. And everybody knows talk is what? Cheap. When I think about This love, I'm reminded of the words of John Wesley, who 275 years ago preached a sermon in Savannah. And he read one verse out of the Corinthians text, the third verse, and it said, "And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me what? Nothing." In this very sermon, Wesley said, some of y'all won't profit from this, because some of y'all aren't serious enough to attend to this scripture on love. And some of you who do attend to the scripture on love, Wesley went on to say, won't really believe it when you're really pressed. And some of you who do believe it will think it's too hard a saying, and we'll forget it as soon as you can. And a few of you will receive it gladly for a minute, but because you lack humility or self-denial when persecution comes because of the word, you will fall away rather than suffer for it. In other words, John Wesley said, somebody has been lying on love. And don't we lie on love every day in this country? I mean, don't we on one hand say, oh, we care, and on the other hand we demonstrate how much we don't care. In other words, Wesley was saying, you know, not only have we been lying on love, but we have been blaming others for what's not happening in our churches. We blame polity and disciplines, legislation, bishops. We blame all sorts of stuff on what's not happening. But the reason I came here today on Sunday is because I know you haven't been lying. I know this church has been demonstrating. You have been practicing what's preached here. And that's huge. There are volumes of works on the study of this thing we call the faith religion. But unless love informs your study of, it's just words on a page. Unless love informs your theology, your God won't be big enough to accept people like me with a past. Unless love informs your soteriology, the saving power of your God won't be big enough, strong enough to overlook the missteps and the mistakes, the miscalculations that life brings on. Unless love informs your eschatology, you won't have enough time to show the love needed to a hurting world. And unless love informs your, I'm making this word up, love-ology, you will continue to punctuate love in some strange ways. You see, some people put commas after love, and that comma after love informs the lover that we must pause. And then some people put parentheses around their love, and those who put parentheses around their love informs the lover that we can only love those within the parentheses. But I am encouraging everybody in this room to love what? Period. See, when you love, period, you stop with love. There's no qualification process after the period. There's no line of demarcation after the period. You stop right at the period and you love right there. Yes, yes. And you have done that. Yes. As I close, and this is a Methodist close, not a Baptist close, Sean. All right. As I close, Jesus asked the young scholar. He said, which one is the neighbor? Young scholar. The young scholar, still unable to say the Samaritan. Still struggling with identification. Said, and this is profound, the one who showed mercy. I'm a product of mercy. Well, Sean didn't tell you, I'm on my 23rd year as a Christian, 22nd year of ministry. Most of my adult life, I ran a business with my dad. And I didn't realize until just really recently that our business was really worse than even I thought it was. But we owned a little borderline bordello on the edge of downtown Houston. Somebody says, "What's a borderline bordello?" I heard your question. Well, it's a place where sex workers work, and we don't get a percentage. We get the rent. And I ran that place my entire adult life. And then God showed me mercy. Brought a woman into my life who took me to church. I wasn't a believer. But I loved her so much, and I loved her expression of the faith so much that I said, "Hey, if you're going to church, I'm going with you because I heard about them preachers." All right. Because my daddy always told me to never trust preachers and church people. He said they were all full of something, and we got kids in the room. All right. But I went to church with her, and I sat on the pew for 5 years. And the people in that church showed me mercy. They didn't really know I didn't believe what they were saying. And the preacher was really a good guy. And he didn't know I wasn't a Christian because I knew how to carry a Bible. You got to carry it just right, you know. Cup your fingers just under there. You know? And people will never know. And I showed up week after week for 5 years. Not believing. And in the last year, 1990, in the last year, a guy named Willie Lane walked up to me and said, "Brother, I want you to join me for Bible study." Well, that really wasn't didn't get it for me. What really got it was, he said, "Every Tuesday night, I'm at Jade Hawaii." It was a Chinese restaurant. I really liked the food, all right? And I met him. And after the first week, I said, "Man, this guy really believes this stuff." And I became intrigued, and I kept showing up. And before I knew it, I was leaning forward. Showed mercy. See, along the way, God has sent a lot of people to cross the street for me. I'm alive today because God sent some people across the street to show me mercy. I never expected to live this long. Man, I'm 57. I have to pinch myself, man. Doggone. I lived long enough to begin to enjoy it. Even though now I do pick my seat on the plane based on its proximity to the restroom, that's no immaterial, all right? You'll get that on the way home. But mercy. And what we also know is Jesus crossed the street and showed some folk some mercy. Samaritan woman at a well. Woman with an issue of blood. Hungry people on a hillside. And so does First Grace. And that's why I'm here today. I'm not telling you anything you haven't already been practicing. I'm not telling you anything you haven't already done in terms of showing mercy to this community. I just came by today to cheer you on. I mean, really cheer you on. If this was the 70s and Don Cornelius was still alive, all right, we start a Soul Train line right here. And that's right. And the music will start. And there would be people on both sides of the aisle, And the person who needed to experience that encouragement most would break into the aisle and start moving down the aisle. You know how that worked, right? You start moving down the aisle. And the people on both sides would say what? They would say, go ahead, all right? Now, let's try this morning. Go ahead, all right? Go ahead. Go ahead. There you go. Go ahead. That's a word for first grace. Go ahead. You know, I gotta tell you this. There are two things that really scare a preacher. All right. The first one is when the church gives you a towel. That means they want you to sweat, all right? And the second one is when they give you water, they want you to preach until you just get thirsty, all right? I miss both of those, but I'm sorry. But go ahead, all right? Yeah, all right.